voters in Turkey are casting their ballots in nationwide municipal elections, where the ruling AK Party is determined to reclaim control of the major cities, Istanbul and Ankara, from the opposition. Thanks for joining us. Nearly 6 months into Israel's genocidal war in Gaza, the regime's attacks on all areas of the besieged territory, including hospitals and displaced people inside, continue. According to Palestinian officials, the regime forces have killed over 400 civilians in the area of Al-Shifa Hospital since the siege began 3 weeks ago. The regime has also destroyed over 1,000 nearby homes, as 107 Palestinians are still trapped at the hospital. Meanwhile, malnutrition has claimed the lives of a child and a young man in Kamal Adwan Hospital. First strikes on aid seekers near Gaza City have killed at least 17 Palestinians, while injuring 25 others. At least 11 Palestinians were killed in the Israeli bombardment of Bani Suhaila neighborhood in the eastern parts of Khan Yunis. In the north, Israeli artillery fire targeted civilians east of Jabalia. The death toll from the Israeli genocide tops 32,700. Several UN agencies have called for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza as the death toll from the onslaught continues to rise. International organizations, including UNICEF and UNRWA, have said that an immediate ceasefire is needed in Gaza to save the lives of people and to provide necessary humanitarian aid. The organizations also warned about the spread of diseases. They said Gaza's health system is collapsing. On Saturday, the World Health Organization said thousands of Palestinians have to be urgently evacuated out of Gaza for life-saving health services. Israeli forces have shot dead a Palestinian for allegedly attempting a stabbing attack in the southern city of Be'er Sheva. Israeli media identified the Palestinian as a young man without offering further details. Israeli authorities said that he was killed on the spot after wounding two people with a knife at Be'er Sheva's main bus station. Palestinians launched a new wave of deadly attacks against Israeli targets since the regime began its onslaught on the Gaza Strip on October 7. We were earlier joined by our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, to get more details about the Be'er Sheva incident.
Palestinian man arrived at the central bus station in Be'er Sheva, or as the Israelis called as Be'er Sheva, and then he had a knife. He stabbed Israelis, wounding at least two. One of them is an Israeli soldier. Israeli police there opened fire, shot him and killed him on the spot. And later they revealed his identity, that he is a man from the Rahat area in the Naqab desert. So we have to mention that in recent months there had been an escalation of anti-Israeli operations, whether stabbings or even opening fire at Israeli forces in the lands that were occupied in 1948. And the Palestinians who are still living in these areas are able to confront the Israeli aggression and the Israeli occupation of 1948 to prove once again that they are Palestinians and that they are still holding to their Palestinian nationality, despite the fact that there are strict measures are being imposed by the Israelis here in the occupied West Bank, in Al-Quds and in the 1948 areas. But at the end of the day, Palestinians are doing their utmost to continue carrying out from a time to another anti-Israeli operations.
Secretary General of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad Movement, Ziad al-Nakhala, has met with Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian in Tehran. The meeting comes only a few days after the political bureau chief of Hamas, Ismail Haniya, arrived in the Iranian capital for high-level talks. Gisumi Shahmadi has the details.
Grounds of solidarity on full display. Secretary General of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad Movement, Ziad al-Nakhala, meeting with Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian to discuss the latest developments in Gaza and the ongoing genocidal war. And later, taking to the same podium as the political bureau chief of Hamas, Ismail Haniyeh, took less than a week ago to thank Iran for playing an important role in supporting the resistance of the Palestinian people.
The Palestinian resistance has always been supported by Iran, which has paid the price for constantly defending Palestinians' rights. Iran's active diplomacy played a leading role in clarifying the position of Palestine's resistance. And the Palestinian people will eventually achieve a final victory in their fight against Israel. They will be a model for all the people of the world.
Words that echo comments made by Ismail Haniyeh, who is also in Tehran for high-level talks. Both officials have met with Iran's leader, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, and other high-ranking officials, including the Iranian president.
These meetings with high-ranking Iranian officials show that Iran plays a significant role as a consulting party. It also shows the high level of coordination between Iran and the axis of resistance, sending a clear message that Iran will always support Palestine.
Meanwhile, these meetings in Tehran come after a UN Security Council resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza, as the U.S. for the first time abstained from the vote, leaving Israel isolated.
The timing of the visits by senior Palestinian officials to Tehran is quite significant, given that, in the course of time, what we have been seeing in the other front, meaning between Israel and its allies, including the United States, is a division among them. And we're seeing that Israelis are losing political and international support day by day. There are issues related to the future of Gaza, future of the war, and some political efforts in order to establish a ceasefire in Palestine. And I think those are important issues which can be and have been raised and discussed in the meetings held in Tehran.
The presence of Palestinian officials in Tehran is a clear display of unity at a time when the international community is showing more solidarity with Palestinians than ever before. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
Polls have opened in Turkey's local elections, where people vote to choose mayors and provincial council members across the country's 81 provinces. Turkey's capital Ankara and the main city Istanbul will be the key battlegrounds between the ruling Justice and Development Party and the opposition. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has described Istanbul as the national jewel and hopes that his AK party regains the city after losing it to the Republican People's Party in 2019. It is believed that Istanbul's mayor, Ekrem İmamoğlu, will be the main challenger to the ruling party in the 2028 presidential vote if re-elected. A correspondent, Russian Sagalam, has been following the developments regarding the elections in Istanbul. She joins us to tell us more. Russian, what do you have for us?
So far, the election is still going and more people are flocking to the polling stations in all over the 81 provinces in Turkey. I am here in Istanbul, in one of the districts of Istanbul that is mainly supporter of the Republican People's Party, CHP, opposition political party. People are coming here to cast their votes and choose the mayor of Istanbul, of course, as the provincial council and district representatives. Let me just mention the numbers that we have. 81 provinces, as I mentioned, 61 million voters, people eligible to vote, and 1 million new voters who are eligible to vote after the 2023 presidential and parliamentary elections. Now, as I mentioned, 81 provinces. Among these provinces are Istanbul, the economic hub, which the competition is very high in. As you mentioned, Ekrem İmamoğlu, the current mayor and the candidate of the Republican People's Party, the opposition political party here in Turkey, and Murat Kurum, the candidate of the Justice and Development Party, are the main candidates in Istanbul. And the competition actually is very high between those two candidates. Of course, there are other candidates from other political parties. We have 49 candidates in Istanbul alone, and there are those who are independent, not with political parties. Now, let me just speak about the problems that occurred from 8 a.m. till now, 1 p.m. Istanbul time. In Diyarbakir, there was one dead and 12 injured in a armed fight in front of a electoral commission. There was a fight on who is going to go inside first, and the fight broke down over there. And there was, as I mentioned, one that 12 injured in Chanli Urfa. There were two fights. And one of these fights happened inside the electoral committee, and then the police intervened. And one of these fights happened outside of a polling station. And there is two injured in Chanli Urfa. So also, when we were rooming the polling station here where we are, we spoke to people and they said they had some complaints about how the election is going. One group said that the independent candidates, their names on the papers are smaller than the names of the political parties. Like, for example, if you are a candidate from a political party, AK party, CHP or whatever, your name will be, or not the name, but the logo of the political party will be bigger, very big. And the name of those who are independent are very small. For elderly people, they cannot really see very well. The names are really small, and there is no sign that this candidate is the independent candidate. So this one of the claims that we heard from the people here. They are also saying that where we are in this polling stations, there is no accessibility for handicaps. However, the police is actually, and I've seen them, the police is actually helping the elderly and handicaps, but there are stairs here and they're very high, actually, so they complained about that. Those are the problems that people have faced here. And also, as I mentioned, the three fights that happened in Diyarbakir and two in Chanli Urfa. Let me also mention that Murat Kurum, the AKP candidate in Istanbul, casted his vote and he called his supporters to go to the polling stations and cast their votes. And he also said that we are ready to celebrate this evening after winning the mayorship of Istanbul. Also, Ekrem İmamoğlu casted his vote, as well as Mansur Yavaş, the CHP candidate in Ankara, and the AKP candidate in Ankara, Turgut Altınok. Also, the EYİ Party, the Good Party leader, Meral Akşener, casted her vote. Özgür Özel, the CHP leader as well, he casted his vote. And Ali Babacan, also a political party leader in Turkey, casted his vote. Actually, it seems that usually in the Turkish elections, whether local or presidential and parliamentary, the participation is usually very high, up to 84% in the last local election in 2019, 84% actually. However, this time it seems that political parties are calling their supporters to go and cast their votes. It seems that the participation until now is not as expected. So as I mentioned, we have 61 people, eligible voters who are supposed to vote. We don't know up till now the numbers. However, it seems the fact that political parties and candidates are calling their voters to go and vote and not to wait until the last minute, it seems that the participation is not as high as expected. As I mentioned before, that whoever wins Istanbul is going to be probably, as okay. said in Turkey, the president of Turkey. So the fight in Istanbul is really tight here. Sure. And in Ankara, I think that the opposition will be winning. This is as per analysts, of course.
Thank you so much for that update. We appreciate it. Roshan Sagalam there from Istanbul. Thank you, Roshan. From Istanbul, we go to Darabala to talk to our correspondent, Muti Abu Musaba, about the developments out of the Gaza Strip. Muti, over to you.
Yes, actually, another flagrant crime was committed moments ago here in the yards of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital after the Israeli warplanes deliberately, intentionally targeted a tent taking shelter by the Palestinian evacuees, in addition to a group of the Palestinian journalists. Its civilians were reportedly killed, in addition to dozens of the Palestinian journalists who got... Yes, it's another abhorrent crime was committed moments ago after the Israeli warplanes deliberately attacked a tent taking shelter by the Palestinian evacuees and the Palestinian journalists in the yards, in the front yards of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital. This tent is located beside the main gate of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital. The Israeli warplanes deliberately, intentionally attacked that tent. At least three Palestinian civilians were reportedly killed over that deliberate attack, in addition to the the injury of five Palestinian journalists. The targeting and the position of the targeting is so close to the place of the media outlets working here in the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital. It's another red line crossed by the Israeli occupation forces in this ongoing and continuous genocidal war in Gaza. For the first time, the Israeli warplanes attacking the yards directly, the yards of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital, without any previous warnings to the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital. It was a sudden attack that deliberately attacked that tent. This is another flagrant crime committed by the Israeli occupation forces, crossing another red line, as I have mentioned. The situation here is chaotic, and there are many rising concerns and fears among the people here, taking shelter in the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital, in addition to the medical staff and the administration of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital, that this attack would be reiterated by the Israeli occupation forces. According to the people here, that they have no place to go. They don't know if the Israeli occupation forces repeatedly attacked the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in the same way. They don't know where to go. So it's another flagrant crime targeted another health facility here in Gaza Strip, amid the continuous attacks that are still hitting and reaching the Gaza's health sector and the health facilities that are still working and functioning inside Gaza Strip. Over to you.
Thank you so much for that. Mutiab Musawa there from Darabala. Thank you. And that does it for this additional World News. Thanks for being with us. It's bye-bye for now.
Imam Sajjad, peace be upon him, has said, "Whenever I remembered the martyrdom of the children of Fatima, peace be upon her, my eyes filled with tears."
Cancer, the new trailblazers.
One of the oldest and most widespread diseases in the world, Cancer has always existed and is found in all living things, including plants. It was once thought to be related to the humours, to be contagious or viral in origin. Today it is believed that the cause may be genetic. In every age, new weapons have been unsheathed against cancer, but none have succeeded in vanquishing it. And yet scientists now are able to decipher some of its most intricate processes. Could these advances have been misleading? Could they have in fact led the scientific community astray?
It now appears very likely that we got lost in the details. Our focus was wrong. We were looking at the details of the engine in the car when that wasn't really the problem.
We tend to research the details without seeing the big picture. We lose the forest for the trees.
Einstein said, for an idea that people don't think is crazy in the beginning, there is no hope.
Time has come in America when the same kind of concentrated effort that split the atom and took man to the moon should be turned toward conquering this dread disease.
It's now been over 40 years since the war against cancer was declared by one government or another.
Le cancer ne sera pas vaincu en un jour.
Today I'm announcing we are directing $30 million of that new budget.
Since then, real progress has been made. We are now able to detect, treat, and prevent cancer much better than in the past. 70% of the cancers that were fatal in the 1950s can now be cured. But such undeniable achievements are, in the end, relatively minimal. In spite of the many billions that have been invested in cancer research in the last half century, mortality rates have not decreased as much as expected. The disease continues to kill 8 million people every year. But how well do we really know this enemy? And to begin with, how do we define it?
Cancer is the dangerous overproliferation of certain cells in the body. When everything interacts in a harmonious way, the body grows. That's what happens in children or in fetal development. When cells multiply in what we call a normal way, the process is harmonious and coordinated. But when the cell proliferation does not respect this process and gets out of line, so to speak, that's what we call cancer.
We have to remember what cancer is. Cancer is a kind of traitorous cell in your own body, and that's one of the things that makes it so diabolical, so difficult to treat. It's your own flesh and blood that has become immortal. The cancer cell is an immortal cell. People don't realize this, but all of our cells are destined to die, and it's actually the death of the cell that's healthy. Our cells regenerate it through death. They're constantly growing. But if a cell stays alive and keeps growing, that is what cancer is.
Where does this paradoxical explosion of life that is cancer come from? How can it be prevented and controlled? Surgery was first used to treat cancer in the 19th century, and then, at the beginning of the 20th century, radiation therapy was developed. Both methods target the tumor, which is a cluster of cancer cells that form in an organ. But these methods do not prevent some of the cells from escaping and spreading to other organs. The resulting secondary tumors, called metastases, are often highly malignant. In order to stop this fatal process, a new weapon was developed in the 1950s. On December 2, 1943, German warplanes bombed the town of Bari in Italy. One of the ships in the harbour exploded. It was carrying 2,000 bombs of mustard gas, a highly toxic poison gas. Over the next few months, more than 1,000 people died, both soldiers as well as civilians. The doctors who treated the victims poisoned by the gas noticed that they had very few white blood cells in their blood. This incident led researchers to come up with a new idea. If mustard gas could kill blood cells, why not use similar toxic chemicals to eliminate cancer cells? That was the beginning of chemotherapy. A few years later, it was being used effectively against previously incurable cancers. However, chemotherapy hits hard and indiscriminately. It kills diseased cells as well as healthy cells. It is a scorched earth strategy applied to the entire organism that is extremely harsh on the body. Its side effects range from nausea to hair loss, to anemia and other immune system disorders. Moreover, while some cancers respond to it, others resist it, for reasons that we're still unable to explain.
The idea of using chemotherapy against cancer was purely pragmatic. We don't know why a particular tumor responds specifically to such and such an agent. However, what we suspected was that chemotherapy acted and could be especially effective on rapidly proliferating cells. That's why pediatric tumors were good targets. But unfortunately, this explanation turns out to be insufficient. So we have made advances, but we do not necessarily understand why we made those advances.
While cancer treatment has progressed significantly, many gray areas remain with regard to the disease itself. In the 1970s, it was thought that the mystery had finally been pierced. Two researchers, Harold Varmus and Michael Bishop, demonstrated for the first time that the enemy might come from within their own cells. It could even be lurking in our genes. For this discovery, they were awarded the Nobel Prize. In order to understand this, we must return to the basic principles of the science of genetics. They postulate that DNA controls everything in our bodies. Cancer occurs when something disrupts the codes that regulate the way everything functions in the body. A gene that is damaged, broken, or undergoes mutation may cause cells to deviate from their genetic programming.
When certain cells start to go out of control, which is the case with cancer, they are no longer following their genetic programming. What happens in this process, which is called mutation, is that the cells change their own DNA. So the DNA is altered, the control mechanism is impaired, and as a result, they escape genetic regulation. That's what is now called the genetic theory, or the mutational theory of cancer, which states that cancer is caused by mutations that occur in cancer cells.
A new era was dawning. Researchers began using new techniques to hunt for oncogenes, those genes whose mutations are the cause of cancer. Robert Weinberg is an iconic figure in the field of cancer genetics. Following in the footsteps of Varmus and Bishop, his work has helped to greatly elucidate the biological factors at work in the development of cancer.
In 1978, we began an experimental procedure that allowed us to demonstrate a year later that, in fact, if one looks into the DNA of cancer cells, one can find their damaged genetic information that is responsible for driving the unconfined, the unconstrained proliferation of human cancer cells. The DNA that we looked at there turned out to be a cancer-causing gene, which is called an oncogene. The oncogene is a damaged form of a gene that resides in normal human DNA, and under the influence of the chemical carcinogen, this gene is mutated, it's altered, so that its altered sequence information now creates an oncogene that persuades the cell to grow without limit, without any confinement, and to grow and form thousands, millions, billions of descendants.
Vast amounts of human and financial resources are thus being poured into the area of oncogene research. Billions are being invested in equipment and technology. The human genome is being mapped. And we will soon know everything there is to know, not only about cancer, but about many other diseases as well. The genetic approach now stands out as the one and only path.
I do think that there is, by now, a commitment to genetics. There is a commitment in our National Institutes of Health. How could there not be? Our director is a geneticist. We have, by now, an enormous infrastructure of biotech companies built over the last 50 years to work with laboratory scientists to study the genetics of this and the genetics of that.
Today, we have dozens of countries across the world really involved in the race to actually sequence cancer genomes, find cancer genomes. So the science of cancer is really progressed very quickly because we now understand genetics and genomes and we can actually catalog mutations.
Canadian scientist Thomas Hudson runs a large international consortium that is in the process of completing the sequencing of 25,000 tumors.
Our ability to not just discover cancer genes, but rapidly understanding the biology of the cancer genes, at least, and try to make drugs for the most important ones, is actually becoming almost routine.
When I was studying the rise of oncogene research, it was a new bright star, right? It was a hope. People really thought that we were getting to the cause, the basic causes of cancer, and that it would eventually lead to solutions, to treatments.
In the late 1990s, drugs designed to target and affect the behavior of cancer-causing genes were developed. Next to chemotherapy, these so-called targeted treatments appear to be considerably less destructive. Their impact on the body is gentler, with fewer side effects. The pharmaceutical industry has invested massively in these new therapies, which represent more than half of the anti-cancer drugs now being developed. 200 products are already on the market, and 900 are in preparation.
There are a lot of advances happening in oncology today because of targeted therapies. And we know that some, like Gleevec, actually have a long response. But the disappointment is many of the new targeted therapies don't last as long. And so there's limitations in terms of their effectiveness for patients. It could be, 3 months, a year. But very often the disease comes back and can overcome that resistance.
Drugs such as Gleevec and Herceptin have without question contributed to advances in the treatment of certain leukemias and breast cancers. But for almost all of the other cancers, the results have been disappointing.
In principle and logically, targeted therapy is much more promising. The unfortunate outcome, however, is that targeted therapy often works brilliantly, but after 6 or 7 or 8 months, the cancer cells figure out a new way to start proliferating, and these newly formed cancer cells are no longer affected by the initially introduced drug.
It means that we would become caught up in a never-ending chain of events without ever really arriving at a cure. That, I think, is one of the limitations of targeted therapies.
Why is it taking so long for the genetic revolution to come up with effective treatments? It is now estimated that over 2,000 genes might be involved in various cancers, and that the mutation rate could be 1,000 times higher depending on the tumor. And the further we probe, the more complicated it gets.
The major challenge that we have is to understanding what the data means. I was part of the Human Genome Project during the 1990s, and we sequenced that whole genome. It took 10 years, and we still don't understand most of the genes and the proteins and what the genomes do. So we still, our ability to do an interpretation of one genome, a whole community of scientists across the world is still challenged. It's how difficult it is.
The information, the technology for analyzing cancer cells is now so powerful that we are being inundated, we are being flooded with large amounts of information that vastly exceed our capabilities of digesting the information and understanding its implications. Clearly, without understanding what makes cancer cells grow abnormally, our hands are tied in terms of being able to create new kinds of therapies.
There are people who cynically would say, if you have a hammer, every problem is a nail. Cancer genes are now the nails. Because we have molecular genetic tools, we can go and hammer on cancer genes. So the question of, is this the best way to study cancer? Was it the best way? It was, in a certain sense, the best way given the tools that people had. Was it the solution to the problem of cancer?
In the early 1990s, patient advocacy groups were formed in protest against this fixation on genetics. They criticized its lack of therapeutic results. The organization Breast Cancer Action was founded in San Francisco in order to get cancer research out of its rut by challenging, first of all, its dogmatic focus on genetics. Yes, inherited gene mutations may increase the risk of cancer, but only in 5 to 10% of the cases.
When I was diagnosed, that there was a way in which the doctor just wanted to take what he had in front of him. That's to say, you know, a 36-year-old person with this stage breast cancer, and therefore they need this treatment, and throw me into the numbers.
I had a really smart doctor say, well, you don't have a family history. And they said, you can't have breast cancer. And I, oh, okay. And I nodded along, but I did have breast cancer, and I was, you know, had done all those things you were supposed to do. And I felt like it was a revolution for me to find out the things I found out.
Inheriting a gene does not mean that you will get breast cancer. And we really do have to look at the inherited gene and environment interactions and why for some people it leads to cancer and for some people it doesn't.
But I think in the last 10 or 15 years, there's been so much concentration on genetics. And I see it in other diseases where they've accounted for the incidence of these various diseases because of genes that they've identified that people have in common. I don't know how that affects breast cancer, but I know that in general that this investment that genetics explains everything has kind of put things off track.
Could the scientific community have been on the wrong track for the last 30 years? Have we in fact come to a dead end?
By looking at these details, it looks as if we lost the forest for the trees, as Americans would say. And the holistic view became less prominent.
Back in the 1970s, research by American biologist Mina Bissell tended to prove that cancer arises from an interaction between certain cells and their environment. She was one of the first scientists to challenge the genetic theory of cancer.
When you take these cells from the person and put it in a dish, or from an animal and put it in the dish, the genes are not fixed. They are regulated by context. They are regulated by microenvironment. So that just clarified a lot of things for me, that, again, context or microenvironment. And in this case, the architecture of the tissue was very, very important. And once you destroyed the architecture, that, in combination with the oncogene, could make a tumor.
But at the time, the budding sphere of genetics was monopolizing all of the attention, and Mina Bissell's work was virtually ignored.
People say Mina is a pioneer. They say she's a visionary. Some people say. Some people think I'm crazy still. But no, I didn't think I never thought. I just was curious. We published the papers in very many good journals, and the reactions basically were disbelief, or nobody paid attention. People would not quote them. They would not say this. It's only in the last 10 years or so that a lot of very well-known people are aware of the work, and they quote it, and they also say it's pretty obvious.
In order to understand cancer, do we need to change our focus? Should we examine cells in interaction with their environment? Consider how they breathe, eat, and develop. Observe them like we would observe an animal or a plant living within an ecosystem.
In a forest, if there's a plant or an animal species that proliferates to the point of destroying the ecosystem, that is literally the equivalent of cancer in the body. Rather than seeing the body as something that functions under the centralized control of our DNA, If we see it as a self-regulating system, like a forest or an ocean, we will then start to look at how the element that is proliferating gets access to nutritional resources and will study the predators. So, for example, if a certain type of rabbit suddenly begins to multiply to the point of destroying the forest, we're not going to say, oh, the rabbit has mutated. We would wonder instead if carrots hadn't become more abundant for some reason, or if some of the other species that would normally compete with the rabbits hadn't disappeared. Or whether the foxes that kept a check on the rabbit population hadn't some kind of problem that year. And so all of a sudden, instead of looking for mutations, you're faced with a more global vision of balances and imbalances.
Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace be upon him, has said, whoever remembers us to Ahlul Bayt and his or her eyes fills with tears, his or her face will never burn in the fire of hell.
This is
for a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثتُ لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم dear listeners, welcome back to a new episode of For a Better Life. Once again, we have the opportunity to be here together in order to talk more about ways, rituals, and Islamic principles in order to have a better life. In this episode, specifically in awe of the glorious and holy month of Ramadan, we're going to talk more about this specific month and the rituals that as Muslims we have to take and commit in order to take benefit of this holy month. As you know, Ramadan is considered one of the holiest months of the year for all Muslims around the world. In Ramadan, Muslims commemorate the revelation of the Quran and fast from food and drink during the sunlit hours as a means of drawing closer to God and cultivating self-control, gratitude, and compassion for those less fortunate. Ramadan is a month of intense spiritual rejuvenation with a heightened focus and devotion, during which Muslims spend extra time reading the Quran and performing special prayers. So, those unable to fast, such as pregnant or nursing women, the sick, or elderly people and children are exempt from fasting. But I hope that as Muslims, we all have the opportunity and the blessing in order to be able to fast in this holy month of Ramadan. Actually, there are so many philosophy behind this active fasting in Muslim community that we're going to go through every and each one of them one by one. And not only the spiritual benefit of this holy act that we do in order to get closer to Allah Almighty, but also there are so many physical benefits of this action. As you know, Muslims fast from pre-dawn to sunset, a fast of between like 11 to 16 hours, depending on the time of year, for a period of 20 to 30 days. And Ramadan entails foregoing food and drink, and there are not only physical restriction of this holy month of Ramadan, but also there are so many other criteria of this month, specifically the spiritual fasting that we have. As you know, there are different levels and categories of fasting, and the first and the easiest level of fasting is fasting from food and drink. And in next levels, you have to keep your tongue, you have to keep your hand from committing sins. And as we all know, this tongue is one of the tools of committing sins, like telling lies, like backbiting, like insulting other people. And one of the most important rituals and benefit of the holy month of Ramadan is for you in order to practice keeping your tongue from all the sins that we mentioned, some of them. So, dear listeners, let's go for a short break, then we're going to come back. Stay tuned.
Your mercy, your love is all I need.
Welcome back to this episode of For a Better Life. We are here talking about Ramadan and its benefits for every Muslim, and not only Muslims, but all the people who have an interest in order to know more about Allah Almighty and the creator of this beautiful and wonderful creation. So, as we talked about it in the first part of our episode, for Muslims, Ramadan is a time to train themselves both physically and spiritually by avoiding any negative acts, such as gossiping, backbiting, lying, or arguing. Muslims welcome Ramadan as an opportunity for self-reflection and spiritual improvement, and as a means to grow in moral excellence. So, Ramadan is actually also a highly social time, as Muslims invite each other to breakfast together and meet for prayers at a mosque. So there are both individualistic and personal and social aspect of the holy month of Ramadan. About the people who are able to fast in this holy month, I can tell you that all Muslims who have reached puberty are obligated to fast. However, people for whom fasting would be a hardship are exempted from fasting, and this includes anyone who is sick or traveling, women who are pregnant, nursing, or on their menses, or older people who are too weak or ill to fast. So they should make up the fast later, except for those who cannot fast due to age or chronic illness. As we see, even at this level of a religion, there are so many beautiful and delicate details for all the people in different situations to have their benefits from the holy month of Ramadan without putting any harm to themselves. So, for those people who cannot fast due to age or chronic illness, instead they can feed a poor person for every day of fasting which they miss. There are other routines and rituals related to this holy month of Ramadan. The thing that I'm going to focus on in this part of our episode is the special activities, specifically the social ones that we can meet and we do in the holy month of Ramadan. Many mosques, as we know, host daily community dinners where Muslims can break their fast together. This is a great service for students, the poor, and anyone who desires a break from cooking. So many mosques also host a community dinner on the weekends. And another special dimension to the holy month of Ramadan is about the prayers that are held in most mosques after the night prayer. During these prayers, the prayer leader recites at least 1/30 of the Quran so that by the end of the month, the entire Quran will have been recited. And since Ramadan is a time for Muslims to be especially charitable, and fasting helps Muslims feel compassion for the hungry and less fortunate, many mosques hold food drives of fundraisers for charity during Ramadan. And many mosques also host open houses for their friends and neighbors of other faiths to join them for their fast break and dinner or iftar at the end of the fasting day. There are so many details and so many blessings of the holy month of Ramadan, like night of power known as Laylatul Qadr, which is believed to fall on one of the odd nights during the last 10 days of Ramadan, but is most widely observed in the 27th night of Ramadan, and is considered the most blessed night in Ramadan because it is believed to be the night in which the Quran was first revealed. Mosques are open all night as Muslims hold prayers, Quranic recitation, and contemplation. At the last part of our episode, I want to mention the relation between fasting and this month of Ramadan and the revolutions, the inner and personal revolutions that you can go through in this holy month of Ramadan in order to have a better life. Don't forget that the goal of this program is for us to be here and talk about different aspects of life and improve the level of our knowledge in order to choose the right path to the destination of satisfaction of Allah Almighty. So, as I mentioned, month of Ramadan is a very specific and holy opportunity for people who are seeking for days of piety and virtue in order to get closer to Allah Almighty. May Allah bless all of us and put us from the group of people who benefit from this holy month. Thank you, dear listeners, for listening to me. That was all the time I had for today's episode. I wish you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Every grain of sand in every desert land he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share he knows. Thank you.
Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Riza, peace be upon him, has said, "If you are filled with joy when you are with us, the Ahlul Bayt, in the upper reaches of the heaven, then be sorrowful when we are sad, and be joyous when we are joyous."
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines this hour. Israeli forces continue to attack Gaza's hospitals and the displaced people taking shelter there as the regime's genocidal war enters its 177th day. Several international aid organizations call for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza, warning that the health system in besieged territory is on the verge of collapse.